Defense officials emphasized the importance of strengthening bilateral coordination to effectively secure the porous border with Pakistan, a critical priority for both nations due to their shared security challenges, while assuring Tehran of its full support to increase collaboration on regional peace and security. Islamabad expressed serious concerns over Israel's recent military aggression against Iran, describing it as a violation of international law and an infringement on Iran's sovereignty. To bolster defense, industrial, and technological cooperation with Pakistan, Iran will participate in the International Defense Exhibition, scheduled to be held next week in Karachi.
The shared resolve between Tehran and Islamabad to fortify their defense and security partnership is expected to play a key role in advancing regional stability and sustainable development. Nasik Azmi, Islamabad.
At South Korea's National Assembly Wednesday, the export of weapons to Israel came under the scrutiny of lawmakers as Israel's genocide in Gaza continues. Researchers outlined the complicity of several nations, particularly the United States.
The United States, which provides the largest amount of weapons to Israel, has provided more than 50,000 tons of weapons and military equipment since October 7, 2023. Germany, the UK, Canada, France, Italy, Australia, South Korea, and other countries are also supporting massacre by arming Israel with bombs, bullets, jets, and fuel.
Seoul has seen weekly demonstrations in support of Palestine over the past year. Still, South Korea continues to export weapons to Israel worth millions of dollars. Recognizing those guilty may bring change.
If more countries take measures within their own countries, wouldn't that be a way to pressure the United States? That's why we're filing criminal charges against Israeli war criminals in South Korea. And even though South Korea isn't doing much, there are still declarations to stop exporting weapons to Israel.
Legal decisions condemning Israel's occupation and genocide from the International Criminal Court and International Court of Justice seem to be inspiring legal authorities within countries around the world. Charges of complicity in Israel's genocide of Palestinians are also extending beyond states. A panel of 30 UN experts warned arms and ammunition manufacturers that by exporting weapons to Israel, together with their investors, they may be complicit in serious violations of international human rights law. Supporters of Palestine are pressing forward with more demonstrations demanding an end to Israel's genocide, with a global day of action slated for November 16th. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In a humanitarian artistic initiative, artists from Jordan and other Arab countries have presented a powerful collection of paintings portraying the suffering of children in Gaza amidst the Israeli aggression on the blockaded territory. This exhibition, titled Painting Joy, was organized by the Jordanian Association of Fine Artists.
We organized this exhibition in collaboration with the Ministry of Culture and as part of the Jerash Festival, with all proceeds dedicated to supporting our brothers and sisters in Gaza. Jordanian and Arab artists stand in solidarity with the people of Gaza and Lebanon.
Certainly, the tragedy unfolding in Gaza right now calls for empathy and support from the entire world. As fine artists, our mission is to help the world grasp the depth of suffering endured by our brothers and sisters in Gaza and Lebanon. We express this tragedy in the way we know best, through our art.
Released Palestinian prisoner Isra Jabis attended as the guest of honor, showcasing several of her own artworks and introducing her debut book in pain. Her presence highlighted the vital role of art in expressing solidarity with just causes.
Powerful messages are conveyed through each painting. One piece of art reflects my own pain as Isra Jabis, while another tells the story of a Palestinian woman during the war who was exposed to toxic fumes and gave birth to a deformed baby.
The participating artists highlighted art's role in expressing empathy for humanitarian struggles, emphasizing that the Jordanian people have always stood in solidarity with Palestine as part of the Arab countries' enduring commitment to the Palestinian cause. The exhibition featured 39 diverse paintings reflecting a wide array of artistic styles.
Art is a powerful tool for change, delivering important messages to the world. This exhibition highlights the suffering of Gaza's children and calls for international and Arab communities to stand in solidarity. Zaid Agarbe, Amman.
UNRWA was founded with the primary aim of addressing the needs of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who were forcibly expelled from their homes and villages. Established in 1949 in the aftermath of the Nakba, UNRWA has been pivotal in providing essential services to millions of Palestinian refugees. For over seven decades, it has worked tirelessly to deliver education, healthcare, and social services to refugees in the Gaza Strip, the occupied West Bank, and the neighboring countries such as Lebanon and Jordan. Reports indicate that UN staff and warehouses are being directly targeted, leading to damage to two-thirds of the agency's facilities. With a significant increase in displacement and infrastructure destruction, civilians are increasingly reliant on the agency's limited services. The Israeli regime has recently enacted new laws that make it impossible for UNRWA to operate. This development follows funding cuts to the agency from several countries, including the United States. Critics argue that these actions undermine the humanitarian principles and worsen the suffering of already vulnerable Palestinian population, leading to catastrophic consequences for health, education, and social support in a region already grappling with significant hardships.
In these critical times, and as the dire situation evolves, the fate of UNRWA and its vital services are hanging in the balance, raising urgent questions about the future of the Palestinian refugees and the broader implications for the regional stability. Ghada Ibrahim, Deir al-Balah.
The main market in the city of Khan Yunis, where people come every day in search of food they can afford to satisfy their hunger. Famine has again returned here as Israel continues to block crossings and restrict the entry of aid and basic necessities in the southern parts. This, as Israel repeatedly says, is thus the safe haven for those remaining in the besieged north.
I have been displaced here since May, and let me say that the situation here in the south is no better than in the north. We lack basic needs such as food, flour, and vegetables. Do you see this tomato? I can't even afford this one tomato, as the prices of available items and vegetables are astronomical. We receive no aid as the crossings are closed. It would cost us a fortune to get one decent meal.
With the market shelves and vendors empty except for a few items available at astronomical prices, the Gazans find themselves looking for whatever they can afford to satisfy their hunger, even it was rotten bread.
We were displaced from Jabalia because we were told that the situation here in the south was better. But we have been struggling every day for more than a year in search of food to feed our children. We can barely find any flour to make some bread. I wish we had stayed in the north and never left.
According to the United Nations World Food Programme, the ongoing crisis could escalate into famine. But Gazans say this is the least that could be said to describe the situation here. What is happening is systematic starvation to kill those who survive the bombardments.
My son asked this morning to make him some salad. Can you imagine? He just asked for a salad, and I couldn't fulfill his wish because we can't afford vegetables. They are scarce and extremely expensive. I own this vendor, but there is nothing to sell because products are banned and people can't afford what is available. And they certainly do not receive aid as Israel prevents it.
Whether in the north of Gaza or here in the south, Palestinians continue to struggle to secure a decent meal for their children. This daily suffering persists while Israel's genocides claim their lives without allowing them the dignity of dying without hunger. Ahmed al-Najjar, Khan Yunis.
Yemen's naval forces are creating their own parting of the Red Sea to help liberate Palestinians from Israel's genocide in Gaza. The maritime divide by Yemen aims to block vessels linked to Israel while allowing those without ties pass unhindered. According to military officials, Israeli-linked companies are currently trying to fabricate digital data and information to hide their association with Israel so they can pass Yemeni waters.
The Zionists are trying to deceive the world by using unlawful tactics to change the ownership names of vessels and companies associated with them. This will not work. We have enough information, and we know all the names and companies linked to the Zionist entity.
Through advanced data-gathering methods, Yemen's ground and naval forces are equipped to take precise actions against vessels engaging in deceptive practices.
Yemen's intelligence and security have reached advanced capabilities. We can obtain any information we want from any source. All information is then submitted to decision makers, who make informed final decisions.
The Red Sea, a strategic yet contested waterway, has become an advantage point for Yemen as they intercept potential threats and block Israeli-linked vessels from advancing undetected. Officials emphasized that fortified naval defenses serve as a crucial line of resistance against covert U.S. and Israeli incursions.
Yemeni territorial waters are considered to be the most strategic yet vulnerable access point the enemy could use against Yemen. Therefore, it was a top priority to advance our naval capabilities, and now these waters have become our strongest weapon, which we are using against the enemy.
Yemen's operations in the Red Sea are specifically aimed at pressuring Israel to end its genocide in Palestine, as well as its military offensive in Lebanon.
Yemen's armed forces say they are now in a stronger position than ever to continue anti-Israel operations in the Red Sea and even beyond. Meanwhile, it seems that Yemen will need to rely more on intelligence gathering in order to continue these calculated naval operations. Yusuf Mawdi, Sana'a.
Nasruddin Amir, the head of the Yemeni Sabah news agency, revealed that the United States had messaged Ansarullah leaders seeking permission for an American aircraft carrier to pass through the Red Sea without incident. However, according to Amir, that request was outrightly rejected and the aircraft carrier subsequently became a target.
There is American hegemony in the region, and it is historically known that neighboring countries are subject to this hegemony, and we believe that they may join any aggression against Yemen, as they did in previous years, with American support. So far, there is nothing new in the negotiations to stop the war on Gaza and Lebanon, and the American administration lies more than it breathes, and all matters are heading towards escalation, especially with the approach of the Iranian response.
A new statement, Amir claimed that the U.S. and Israel are actively pushing for escalation, aiming to draw other countries in the Middle East into the conflict, a move he warns could ultimately place American interests in jeopardy. He also stated that Yemeni officials have sent multiple warnings to nearby countries, urging them to avoid being drawn into what he called American attempt to widen the war, and warned that participating in this war could have dire consequences.
There is no doubt that if America and Israel wage a war on Yemen, Saudi Arabia and the Emirates will be forced to engage in this war, and this will be done indirectly by supporting and financing Yemeni mercenary factions, supplying them with weapons, and spending on military operations in full because these countries fear appearing in the picture, knowing that Yemen will not hesitate to target them with ballistic and hypersonic missiles.
These remarks come after a recent series of diplomatic meetings led by U.S. Ambassador to Yemen Stephen Vagan, who has reportedly been working to coordinate with Saudi and Emirati-backed factions in Yemen. His efforts aim to ramp up tensions in Hudaydah, a city crucial for Yemen's coastal defense along the Red Sea. Observers say the latest developments are part of a larger pressure campaign by the U.S., Britain and Israel, seeking to push Ansarullah and the Yemeni military into lifting the naval blockade, as well as to halt Yemen's military support for Gaza and Lebanon.
With Ansarullah rejecting U.S. requests and issuing warnings to neighboring countries, the risk of Yemen becoming a battleground grows by the day. How far this escalation will go remains uncertain. But for now, the message from Yemeni officials remains clear. This is a warning to those who would bring the war closer to Yemen's shores. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Polls show Muslim Americans are capable of tipping the balance in the several swing states which will decide the Electoral College, but Vice President Kamala Harris's participation in the Gaza genocide has shocked voters of all types.
There are some elections that are a referendum on a specific question, and the question here is not stopping the right-wing maniac. I don't want Trump in office. This election is a referendum on Gaza, and I think the anti-war movement and all people that are, you know, standing in horror at the genocide that's going on every hour on our phones, we can watch it. We have to vote, you know, with that in mind. So I cannot vote for the Democrats.
There's no lack of major issues for voters to consider. Record inflation, the failed war in Ukraine, the January 6th rebellion, the alleged political weaponization of the judicial system, COVID, soaring inequality, increased censorship, a deeply divisive Republican candidate in Donald Trump, and much more.
I think that is also a referendum on the issue of inflation and COVID recovery. You know, we're the richest nation in the world, and there were still millions of people that were evicted, millions of people that lost their homes, and everybody has suffered the insurmountable issue of inflation in this country. And I think most people feel, while the administration insists that the numbers are improving, they don't feel that they are, you know, in a comfortable place economically.
Polls show the Republicans are likely to win the upper house of Congress, with the lower house too close to call. A recent poll found 46% of Republicans and 27% of Democrats said they would not consider the vote's outcome to be legitimate if the other party's presidential candidate wins the election, with 14% of Republicans and 11% of Democrats willing to, quote, take action.
For many, it's been a difficult 4 years. For many others, it's been a difficult 8 years. As America heads to the polls, the only certainty seems to be that division, disunity, dissatisfaction, and maybe even dysfunction aren't going away anytime soon. Ramin Mazahiri, Washington, D.C.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. The
This is the part of this speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with a thousand of veterans and active members in the sacred defense and the resistance field. The meeting took place in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on September 25, 2024. The one who had the intention to attack our orders had planned beforehand. The French government gave Saddam its base aircraft and fighters. The German government provided him with the chemical materials he needed. The US government continuously provided him with intelligence about the battlefield, and neighboring countries provided financial support and resources. This part of the Persian Gulf was a route through which trucks and trailers carrying weapons, equipment, and supplies were constantly moving towards Iraq. One side was like this. The invader was in such a situation. I read in a report that the number of Saddam's fighter jets after the war was greater than the number he had at the beginning of the war. Even though many of his planes had been shot down, the total number of the aircraft he had after the war was higher. That is, he was continuously receiving aid and supplies. This was the situation of the side that was the invader.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
On the other hand, the situation was the exact opposite on the side being attacked, which was us. Our equipment was inadequate, our hands were empty, and our equipment couldn't be replaced. At the beginning of the war, some of the tanks of the 19th Division that are facing the enemy were looted and taken, and nothing was replaced. I went to Ahwaz, where a brigade of the 92nd Division had about 15 or 16 tanks. But logistically, it should have had more than 50 tanks. That's how it was. Nothing was replaced. Whatever we lost was gone. Finished. Our combat organizations had changed. The organization of the army was not prepared for a war. Many of the high-ranking commanders were unfamiliar with the army's resources. The late martyrs Fallahi and Zahir Nejad, who were the heads of the army, were unaware of many things within the military. The reason for this was that the extent of their management was very limited before the revolution. But now they were at the head of the army.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. The UN Human Rights Office has condemned the staggering number of civilians killed in Israel's war on Gaza, with women and children comprising nearly 70% of the thousands of fatalities it had managed to verify. The UN report on the human rights situation in Gaza detailed a vast array of violations of international law, warning that many could amount to war crimes, crimes against humanity, and possibly even genocide. UNRWA says an average of 67 children are killed in Gaza every day. Meanwhile, the United Nations has also warned about the deteriorating situation in northern Gaza. It says Israel's military is preventing food and water from entering the besieged area, where an estimated 95,000 Palestinians are trapped and are in dire need of supplies for their survival. Here are our guests for the show. Spokesperson for the Masar Batil movement, Khalid Barakat, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. And also we have journalist, activist, and director of Palestine Aid Belfast, Fra Hughes, joining us from Belfast.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Barakat in Beirut. The UN Human Rights Office says women and children comprise nearly 70% of the tens of thousands of fatalities, or the thousands, rather, fatalities it has managed to verify in Gaza, and that a vast array of the violations of international law by Israel could amount to war crimes, crimes against humanity, and possibly even genocide. Please unpack this recent UN report for us, which many consider to be stating the obvious.
Yes, thanks for the invitation, and hello to you and your guest. It's not the first, and it's not going to be the last international report documenting Israeli war crime and the genocide taking place in Gaza. Since the establishment of the Zionist regime, we have thousands and thousands of such reports that explicitly says that Israel is committing war crimes as an occupying force of the land. There is hundreds of condemnations, Security Council, the General Assembly of the UN, countless of reports and fact-finding missions that have come to Palestine throughout the years. Of course, we are stating the obvious. However, it's important that these crimes, Israeli crimes, are documented. Although Israel does not care about any international report. In fact, Israel dismisses the UN. It considers it to be an irrelevant institution, although the United Nations is the international institutions that had push for Israel to come into, a member of the UN. However, Israel under the support of the U.S. and the Western allies of the Zionist regime, disregards the UN and all of its reports. Since the establishment of the Zionist regime, not one single time that Israel have implemented a UN resolution or respected a UN report. The Israeli ambassadors in the UN consider this institution to be anti-Semite institution. They called Antonio Guterres, the General Secretary of the United Nations, a persona non grata. And the reason that Israel is doing this is very similar to, regimes throughout, history, especially like South Africa, apartheid regime during the apartheid era and other regimes that disregarded UN and international law. But at the same time, I think that this is just showing again and again how the international community is not doing its responsibility, and that what humanity is being offered today, and not just Palestinians, is that we have to live under a U.S. and Israeli law and not a global system that protects people and protects human rights. And for us Palestinians, really, this is something that, although we have seen it thousands of times, we do believe that it's important to condemn Israeli war crimes and at the same time to show that this is the reason why Palestinians are taking the path of armed resistance, is because the failure of the international community of pressuring Israel to submit to its will and to submit to, international law. And that's why it's important also to escalate Palestinian armed resistance against occupation.
Let's bring in Frau Hughes in the discussion. Mr. Hughes, the UN Human Rights Chief said there must be, quote-unquote, due reckoning for the horrific violations and possible atrocity crimes in Gaza. What good are all these warnings and condemnations when no action is being taken? Prior to this recent report, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights said Israel's practices could amount to atrocity crimes and it may expand to crimes against humanity. Well, it has.
Yes, well, you could say that words without action is rhetoric, and that's what we're listening to. Rhetoric from the UN, rhetoric from the EU, and rhetoric from the American administration, from genocidal Joe Biden. People who on one level claim to say they want to see a ceasefire, they want to see peace, they want to see an end to the death, the violence, and the conflict within the region. At the same time, they're supplying political cover, they're supplying weapons, and they're supplying finance in order to keep the apartheid racist regime in Tel Aviv in place. I think it's important to see the conflict, if I could maybe use that word, I know it's a genocidal war on Gaza, and increasingly we can see that in the West Bank and against Lebanon. And I believe that there is a law that is either being passed or is being pursued in the Knesset, where people who are in Palestinians living in historic Palestine pre-1948, if they have relatives in Gaza who are believed to be members of the resistance, that they will be expelled from Gaza, from historic Palestine. So what we're seeing is the legislation potentially already being put in place to, first of all, they've tried to annihilate the people in Gaza. They are destroying the West Bank as we speak. They are attacking Lebanon in a barbaric and unconscionable manner, with the huge loss of civilian life and infrastructure being mirrored in Lebanon, as has been done in Gaza. So they're putting in place plans for the total expulsion of the Palestinian people from pre-1948 Palestine. Now, I've always described what's happening in Israel as a colonial apartheid state. It is a Western imperialist footprint within the Ummah, within West Asia, and it is there to divide the Ummah. It is there to put sovereign nations against each other. Nations that should actually have more in common than they have to divide them. And if you look at North America, we're talking about ethnic cleansing in Gaza. We're talking about genocide. We're talking about starvation being used as a means of war, as a method of subjugation and as a method of ethnic cleansing in the north of Gaza. It's not that long ago. People were mentioning 300,000 people in northern Gaza who were suffering from food insecurity, which is the starvation that the Israelis are bringing upon the civilian population. That's now down to 100,000. They're herding people in Gaza like cattle. They're using tanks, they're using airplanes, they're using artillery, and they're using their navy in order to corral people into smaller and smaller, more densely populated pockets of internally displaced refugees. All easier to drop
right
a £2,000 or a £5,000 bomb on top of people living in tents.
Right. Mr. Barakat, the United Nations has warned about the deteriorating situation in northern Gaza. It says Israel's military is preventing food and water from entering the besieged area, where an estimated 95,000 Palestinians are trapped and in need of supplies for their survival. UNRWA chief had said earlier that Israel is only allowing 30 trucks of life-sustaining provisions into Gaza daily. Where does Israel's claims of self-defense and fighting the resistance in Gaza get tied to starving the innocent children of Gaza?
Starvation and collective punishment is a constant Israeli policies, especially when it comes to civilians, when it comes to, you know, men, women, and children in Gaza. This is an Israeli policy that have been practiced not just since October 7th, but even before that. Throughout the decades, Israel have always besieged Gaza and made sure that food is always shortage, blocking Gaza from land, sea, and air. And at the same time, Israel is making always sure in the last two decades for Gaza not to have a real access to clean water. 10 years ago, the United Nations were talking about how Gaza is going to be a place where people cannot live at that time, and before all of this destruction that happened at the hands of the Zionist army and the Zionist regime. At the same time, every time Gazans try to rebuild their infrastructure, the agriculture sector, the health sector, even small industries, Israel every couple of years attack Gaza and destroy these infrastructure. This happened constantly throughout, since the occupation of Gaza in 1967, throughout, the last two decades, when Israel launched war after another. And Israel doesn't only launch war of destruction against Gaza in 2008, 2009, 2011, 14, 2021, but also between these wars, Israel imposed siege against international law. But I must say that it's not only Israel who's actually doing this. It is the United States. It's Britain, it's Germany, it's France, all of these countries are complicit, including the regime in Egypt, who is also tightening the siege on Gaza and complicit in these war crimes under, a very direct military, Egyptian military and political rules to tighten the siege at the time where Palestinians are going through hell in Gaza. It's also important to see that this is a collective punishment against the people in Gaza and also in the West Bank. This is what Israel do in every refugee camp and city and town in the West Bank, not just Gaza. And sometimes, when there is a military operation or not in the West Bank, the infrastructure and the civilian population is the first thing that Israel attack. And this is a colonialist practice. This is what France did in Algeria. This is what the British did to their colonies everywhere they existed. This is what the Western colonization did in Northern Ireland, in India, in Africa. And so It's not like Palestine is the exception, but what's important to see here is that the Palestinian people are exposing this camp of imperialism, Zionism, and Arab reactionary regimes, and exposing this camp, the international camp that is led by the U.S., who is trying to impose their will on the people who are fighting for their liberation and return to their homes. And that's why we see this conflict. It's not just Israel. Israel is a tool, a proxy of imperialism, mm-hmm. and it wants to become a small partner of imperialism. And they're doing all of this to show that they can be useful for U.S. policies in Western Asia.
Fra Hughes, the world is watching idly as Israel flattens and demolishes Gaza and has murdered over 43,000 Palestinians. The same is happening now in Lebanon. What has to happen for the collective international community to take action and stop these massacres? And in your opinion, where does this leave the credibility of international bodies such as the UN, which have failed the Palestinians and are now failing the Lebanese people as well?
Well, I think if you believe the Lancet, which is the British Medical Association publication, several months ago, they claimed that there are possibly 140,000 Palestinians dead, between people who are missing, people underneath the rubble, people who have disappeared. So if 140,000 deaths in Gaza is not enough to stop the world watching and not intervening, I'm not too sure what will. I mean, there's no magic figure here where if it hits 50,000, all of a sudden the world's going to step in, or God forbid, you know, it hits 100,000, 200,000, 300,000, that they allow 90,000 people in northern Gaza to starve to death before anyone comes to their aid. I believe that the only people who really can have a solid effect upon what's happening in Israel is firstly the Americans. This is an American war. These are American bombs. These are American fighter jets. These are American ships that are being sold or passed on to the Zionist, racist, fascist regime to be used to decimate Gaza and to be a wider threat to the wider region. Israel wants to become it's supposed to be the fourth biggest army in the world. It wants to be the superpower in the region. It wants to destroy any regime that is a bulwark against Zionism. And that started with Iraq. They went on to Libya. They went on to Syria. They now have Iran and Lebanon again in their sights. So the world is doing nothing. I thought potentially maybe the Russians or the Chinese and BRICS, because that's going to be the future, this multipolar world that we're all praying will come into being as soon as possible and be as strong as soon as possible. But in the short term, so long as the Americans and the EU continue to support this racist regime in Tel Aviv, there will be no end to the deaths, there will be no end to the destruction, there will be no end to the famine, there will be no end to the refusal to allow in medicine, clean water. The vaccines that they've allowed in, part of me wonders, if they're bombing Palestinians and the people in Gaza every day and they've murdered maybe 150,000. I couldn't even understand why they let that vaccine in, unless, of course, there's something potentially in the vaccine other than the polio vaccine itself, which is something that I would personally be concerned about. But it's true that Israel is a colonial state. It wants to displace and then replace the indigenous population, and they're doing that through a campaign of murder, bombing and mayhem. The UN is useless because it was set up, as we all know, after the Second World War. It replaced the League of Nations. It has the six permanent members of the Security Council, which is Britain, America, France, Germany, China and Russia. And when you have France, Germany, America and Britain as four permanent members of that council, they are always going to support Israel because it is a colonial state and they are all former colonial empires. And they stand by each other and they stand by the genocide that they committed in the past and are watching happen today.
Mr. Barakat, if no action is being taken with regards to the Israeli crimes and all the violations that they're committing, and there's no accountability for the Israeli regime. Won't this just happen again and again, and maybe even set a precedent, a very dangerous precedent, for similar massacres to take place in the future?
Absolutely. And this is what the Western imperialist powers wants to do. They want to say that this globe, this world, is going to be run by imperialist forces, and without having a real international force that push back these imperialist forces, we are going to witness more and more dangerous wars led by the United States and by countries like, you know, Israel. And we see that the role of Germany, for example, by funding this genocide, supporting Israel with every military and political, you know, means. At the same time, the forces that have been killing our people in the global south, and not just in Palestine, are the same forces. That's why our war is against Western imperialism and against Zionism. And it's very important to always see that there is two camps in our region. There's a camp led by Iran and the people of the West Asia and the resistance movement fighting back and pushing back against these colonialist forces. And so we should not count on, you know, the UN. We should count on ourselves, on our people, on our ability to defend our resources, just like the resistance and what they have been doing in Lebanon. If it wasn't for the resistance in Lebanon, Israel would have plundered all of Lebanese, you know, natural gas and oil and water. And part of why Israel is waging this war against Lebanon is because the resistance in Lebanon have shown an example of real sovereignty in Lebanon by protecting its wealth and by protecting its people and its water. And that's why this is a dangerous example for the U.S. and Israel and the West, that the resistance should, you know, they want to eliminate this example of a real national sovereignty. The same goes on Iran on a global level. They don't want to see a country that is rising, that is building its capabilities, that is extending its hands to the people of the world and trying to provide an alternative path for humanity. They want to eliminate the balance of power that existed once, and to rule the world by U.S. laws and not international laws.
Frahues, let's talk about the elephant in the room, and that's the new U.S. president, well, the president-elect, the incoming president. Will a new U.S. administration make a difference in the current situation in West Asia? Or rephrasing that question would be, what kind of impact will a new U.S. administration have, given the fact that no matter all the differences that the two main U.S. political parties have, they're always on the same page when it comes to their obedience towards the Zionist lobbies?
Yes, I'm not a big fan of Donald Trump. I mean, this is a man who murdered Qasem Soleimani. This is a man who stepped away from the JCPOA agreement with Iran over the nuclear energy program. But outside of that, he didn't start any wars for the 4 years he was there. He is pro-Zionist, 100%. He did bring about the Abraham Accords, and he does seem to have financial interests within Israel and through his son-in-law, Jared Kushner. I think the important thing is, I've always seen Donald Trump not as a politician. Now, he's the elected president of America, but he's not a politician. He's a man with a business background. He sees an issue, he sees a problem, he wants to sit around a negotiating table and bring some form of resolution to the problems. Now, he said he's going to end the war in Ukraine, which I believe he will do. He simply tells Zelensky to sit down around the table with the Russians, maybe go back to the Minsk 1 and 2 agreements that were falsely ratified by the Americans and, the Germans and the French, who said they would be brokers of that. And all that time during that process, they were actually deceiving the Russians and rearming the Ukrainians. He said in one of his hustings before his election in one of the swing states, I think it was Michigan, he told the Palestinian Arab Muslim electorate that he would bring an end to the wars and he would bring peace to the region. Now, whether or not he's allowed to do that is a completely separate issue, because the deep state in America, they simply go to him and say, Mr. President, this is impossible. What do you want to do? But I believe that Harris would have continued with genocidal Joe Biden's actions against the Palestinians and Iran and Lebanon and Syria and Iraq. And I think Donald Trump, okay, I'm hoping he will come in and say, enough's enough, end the war, and tell Netanyahu, if Netanyahu's still in power come January, because that's beginning to look increasingly unlikely, that his time's up.
Thanks a lot, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for tonight's show. Spokesperson of the Masar Battle Movement, Khaled Barakat, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. And thanks to Frau Hughes, journalist, activist, and director of Palestine Aid Belfast, joining us from Belfast. And also special thanks to your viewers for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight. It's good night for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with Ayah 35 to 37 of Surah Ali Imran,